Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Migration Policy Institute. I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou, and the session today is Rethinking National Identity in the Age of Migration. We have with us today a sterling, amazing cast of characters, some of them opportunistically so, and some of them not so opportunistically so. And the fact that Patrick Simon was visiting was essentially the opportunity that I'm referring to. We've had a long relationship with Patrick. Cass, of course, has written for us and continues to write for and with us. But his trip was only, you know, from Atlanta or something to here, so we'll give you credit for that, but not so much credit. And the rest of us, you know, are here anyway. So it is a great opportunity for us to have a conversation on an issue that seems to be going pretty much worse and worse, despite the fact, as you will hear from some of our presenters, besides the fact that in some countries, some of the sort of the temperatures, the fever, may have reached its apogee and may be subsiding. But perhaps for every place where we may see some indicators that this is happening, there are other countries where the fever is going higher and higher all the time. We're joined today, and you have all of their bio sketches here on your chair, but for those of you who haven't had a chance to look at the bio sketches, we're joined today by four exceptional speakers. And to my extreme right, this is not a political statement, we have Patrick Simon, who is the Director of Research at the Institut National d'Études Démocratiques, INET, and also a researcher at Sciences Po, where he teaches sociology and political science and ethnography and policy of the United But Patrick has had a long and extensive record in thinking and researching and writing issues, and thank you, Patrick, for joining us and giving us this opportunity. And next to Patrick is Cass Moodet from the University of Georgia. But before that, he was, in fact, the founding chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Anpa, and has held, you know, many other posts, and has done very important and distinguished activities in Europe. And now, in the past year or two, he has come to the United States. You know, maybe he's fleeing something, or maybe he finds that here things, you know, are better than on his issues than they are in many other places. And to my left, again, geography here, don't forget, we have two long and good friends, personal and friends of the Institute, Charles Kamasaki. Those of you who are from Washington, or for that matter from the United States, it is unlikely that you haven't run across Charles. He has been a main actor, a principal actor on issues regarding immigration, let's say for a few years. Charles, should I give a number or not? No number?
I'm proud of my age.
Okay. He was one, together with Frank, whom I will introduce next, Frank Sherry, he was one of the people who really toiled the good earth, political earth, in trying to bring about the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, to the Washingtonians. And he has always been with LARASA, which is the primary organization for Hispanic, with a Hispanic set of interests. It's a civil rights organization that's about 50 years old or thereabouts. He has been the senior executive vice president for a number of years now, which means that he does everything from washing the dishes to fundraising to dealing with all of the substantive issues and working very, very closely with the CEO of the organization to really manage the place and deliver the many programs that La Raza is responsible for. And to the left of Charles is Frank Sherry, and it's almost impossible not to have come across Frank Sherry because he's on television so much of the time. But Frank has also been a warrior from the olden days. He started his career in Boston, working with Central American refugees, and he came down to Washington to take over the National Immigration Forum, which he led for almost a decade. And then he decided to start his own organization, American Organization, America's Voice, and he's been at the helm of that for about 4 or 5 years now, frankly. 4 years now. And he has been, again, he's a veteran of all of the immigration wars in the United States. But these two individuals are here not because of the immigration wars and what has been done and what hasn't been done, but because they are thoughtful activists and observers of issues that are at the very heart of the topic today, which is how this issue has changed in the United States, how it has sort of become over the past decade or so, how it has become an issue that seems to be concentrated on the issues of illegality, how illegality and illegal immigration has sort of, as it were, become the language through which immigration more generally has been discussed, and of course because the target of these conversations and political actions and all that tend to be people from the region, primarily Mexico, but increasingly, you know, the Northern Triangle of Central America, Guatemala, Salvador, and the Honduras. And of course, if you look at the data in the United States, you will see indeed that a very significant majority, at times probably an overwhelming majority of the people who are here illegally resident, but also a very significant minority of total immigration to the United States comes from the region. So we're going to have a full conversation about these issues. Please note that the event is live streamed. Everything you do and say will be forever, you know, in the web or something. My colleagues always cringe when I say the thing. It keeps everybody's blood flowing. Also, there's going to be a video and audio of that very soon after the event, probably tomorrow, for everyone to see for posterity. So, you're not here to hear from me, which is probably a good thing for you and a good thing for me. I think the order that we're supposed to discuss these issues is that Patrick will go first, and he will be followed by Kat, and then he's going to be followed by Charles, and then Frank. And let me tell you the occasion that sort of created the opportunity for these papers to be written and for this conversation to be had. Among the many MPI activities that are not always obvious on this side of the Atlantic is one of the several flagship initiatives that the Institute does. It is called the Transatlantic Council on Migration, which is a group that we convene, founding members of which are very senior officials from the United States, Canada, and Europe, such people as the former Prime Minister of Italy, Giuliano Amato, who met for a decade the head of the German Parliament, Richard Sigmund. António Vitorino, Deputy Prime Minister of Portugal and most noted Commissioner of Immigration and Related Issues at the European Commission, and from the United States, you know, we have had, of course, Michael Chertoff, the last head of the Department of Homeland Security. There is about four or five additional members, but more importantly, this is what we have created is a safe space in which senior officials and some of the best thinkers and writers on this issue come together twice a year, sometimes three times a year, to discuss a burning issue on migration or something that is related to migration. And last November, I know that a year ago almost, beautiful room at the German Bundestag Parliament, we held a meeting on this very topic. These two gentlemen to my right wrote pieces for that meeting, and the book that emanates from that meeting is going to be released on the 14th of November. It will be released in an event in Germany, in Berlin, and it will be available, and you have all this information on your chairs, it will be available through the Bertelsmann publisher, who is a partner of the Migration Policy Institute on this in this effort. So I have asked Patrick to spend about 15 minutes talking to us about some of very compelling findings, research findings that he has written about France, but more broadly about the issue to the extent that you wish to go broader than France. And then Kat will go second. Patrick.
Thank you, Dimitri. I'm very happy to be at the API today, because usually we meet in Europe, but for the first time we reverse the role, so that's a great venue to present this paper. I will begin to do the reverse. I will draw the picture at the beginning, and then I will focus on France. And the topic of this session about the national identity in the age of migration fits pretty well in the French case. You may know that the notion of the concept of national identity is a contentious issue in Europe today, in most of European countries, not only France, but UK, Belgium, Germany, Belgium for different reasons, by the way, Germany, or the Netherlands. So it seems that the conflation of the entering of most of the European countries in an age of diversity, not only migration but diversity within, has reached a peak point with putting into question how national identity is based and how it aims at creating more cohesion among those who are living in this country. And in what the debate clearly shown is that there are some conflictual ideas about the future of how the nations may create the conditions for putting people together in a more harmonious or creative way, and are able to update what I would call the national software according to the new conditions that are demographic and social and ethnic and racial conditions of this society. So I will focus a bit on France in this general landscape, because I think France may be perceived or identified as the country of civic citizenship. Well, you know how the French are, they already think that they are the something. So,
so is it suggest that you're now in a country that thinks that we are competitive?
It's a poor imitation anyway. So France tends to define itself as a civic citizenship country, which means that the participation to society is granted by the citizenship, and then it is granting beyond any class, racial, religious distinction. So the idea is that thanks to this access to citizenship and participation through citizenry, it is a way to create this cohesion beyond any kind of differences within. So the main question is, does it work? It seems that it has worked for alleged to have worked. But in the history, national identity has always been a generous space because it creates avenue for creating inclusion, clearly, but it's also a way to create exclusion by dividing those who are in, we, and those who are out, them. And the condition to move from them to us is a critical thing that is at stake when we talk about the crisis of national identity in most of European countries. So, since France defines itself as a civic citizenship, it means the condition to have access to citizenship was ruled by the by the code of nationality code, which is supposed to be quite open. So, a bit less open than the American one. It's not a pure birthright citizenship. It's a sort of an intermediate, which is pretty weird, which means, to put it very quickly, that the children of immigrants born in France are not French by birth, but they became automatically French when they come at age. So at 15 years old, all the children of immigrants are automatically French. So they are in a sort of a transitory state when they grow up with the foreign citizenship that will be turned automatically without any specific action from their side in French citizenship. This is the situation for more than one century ago, and it hasn't changed that much, except for a short period between 1993 and 1998. The second way to become French, if you're not born in France, is to apply for naturalization, of course, which works like in every country in the world that you have to apply and stay as a derogatory statement about the fact that you may be entitled to be a citizen or not. And this decision is based on different criteria, including an assessment of assimilation, which means applicants are screened out and should give proofs of their assimilation to the society. What is assimilation? Well, it seems it's a very fuzzy definition of it, but it has tightened a bit in the last years and add to this picture the fact that citizenship was ruled in a certain way in the mainland of France and a different way in the colonial empire, because France used to have a large colonial empire, which means citizenship has a double standard system, one for the mainland and one for the colonies in which access to citizenship was ruled in a very different manner, which may have an impact in these days when a large number of migrants come from the former colonial empire. So it has some kind of long-term consequences. But I won't develop that yet. So this trans curves give you the blue one is the proportion of immigrants during the century, and you see that the scale is on the right side, and the pink one is the proportion of French citizens among the immigrants, so naturalized immigrants among the total population of immigrants, and the scale is on the left side. So what you see is that there is a steady growth, but not that big, of immigration in France during this century, and now the proportion of immigrants is 10%, not very far from the American standard. The proportion of second generation in France today is 12%, very close to the American standard again. So a bit close to a fourth of the French population is immigrant or second generation altogether. And the proportion of French citizens among them is quite high. So for the second generation, almost 100% of them are French due to this code of nationality. But for the immigrants, you see that almost 45% of them are French yet. So there is the system of this code of nationality is quite efficient to try to change immigrants into Frenchmen, say like that. So it seems the system works well. It has been under attack these last 5 years, and one of the consequences of this debate about the national identity and the perception of threats, which could be described on two main sources. The first one is the fragmentation from within, the fact that this ethnic increasing ethnic diversity inside create conditions to fragilize the cohesion of the French society. It is the perception that is overwhelmingly dominating in the French public opinion. The second one is the homogenization from above, which is the trend from the organization and the trend to try to go in the direction, I don't know if it will be the case, of federal states in Europe, which is somehow in competition with the national identity for each European country. So it creates some kind of anxiety around these two trends. And one of the consequences of these anxieties has been the organization of a great national discussion on national identity to redefine what was the French national identity at the end, at the beginning of the 21st century. It has been a very tedious and poisonous debate, and mostly revolving around the fact that immigrants of second generation were perceived as not playing the game, not really part of the community, not really loyal and attached to the French national identity. That was the general idea behind the debate. And one of the consequences of this debate has been the development of a selective approach of citizenry, which goes through the creation of the civic test, which is in addition with the assimilation test I was referring to, and more control on the naturalization procedures. And the consequence has been immediately visible. As you see, 2010, this is the annual numbers of citizenship acquisition. So the blue line is all type of acquisition, including by marriage or whatever. And the pink one is by naturalization directly. And you see that there has been a steep decline of 35% of naturalization in this single last year, in 2011, which means this debate has created really the condition to reduce sharply the decision making by public authorities in charge of attributing the French citizenship to candidates and to have this kind of consequence. So I will try to be faster for the last part. So you will have a lot of data coming from the survey that I won't describe, which basically try to see beyond the fact that you can become French, what does it mean? Because it's not enough to have the papers, not enough to have the legal status. To be part of the national community, you should be accepted as a member of the community. To move from them to us, has to give some room inside. And this is a critical point. And my argument is that it's not me. In fact, beyond the fact that most of immigrants and all the second generation do have a French citizenship, they're not perceived, not all of them are perceived as members of the national community, which is somehow shedding light on the meaning of being French. So the first level is being French. That means having the citizenship. And you see that if 72% of the immigrants who came as adults are French, it's are foreigners, I mean, are not French, it's only 40% of those who arrived at young. So the generation 1.5, so to say, those who arrive beyond, before the age of 15. So they get the French citizenship quite fast in some way. And those who are born, as you see, are almost all of them French. Secondly, there is a rise in the dual citizenship. 10 years ago, only 15% of second generation were dual declared a dual citizenship. And you see yet that almost a third of the second generation will declare having a dual citizenship. And depending for the nationality, it could be pretty high. Quite low for the Asians, and pretty high for the Mongolians, and very high for the Turks. So there is an ongoing process of multiple citizenship somehow, which is taking place. Secondly, feeling French. So we ask a question about how do you feel French? Do you feel something close to your country of origin or the country of origin of your parents? And again, well, there is no wonder most of the second generation to declare that they are French, but there is not an issue of loyalty. Belongings are clearly oriented toward French society, but not only, because they mix with feeling of belongings to the country of origin of their parents as well. So there is not a specific contradiction between feeling French and feeling Algerian, Italian, Spanish, or Malian, depending on the country where their parents come from. And you see the 40% of the immigrants who do not have the French citizenship do define themselves as French. So it's even more than those who do have the citizenship to be French, those who do not have the citizenship but live in France to define themselves as French. So it seems that the system is quite efficient to create this belonging, sense of belonging. And this is the illustration of the combination, the multiple belongings I was referring to. You see that mostly for the immigrants, dual belonging and the belonging to the country of origin are the predominant behavior. But when you move to the second generation, dual belonging is the most frequent situation. And when you arrive to generation 2.5, which are those who are born in France with one immigrant parent and one French parent, in this case, the feeling of being exclusively French is increasing in this case. So just keep in mind that there is a sort of pattern of this assimilation process that we were talking about at the beginning is somehow taking place quite quickly over 1.5 generations, let's say. But this doesn't mean that the mainstream population do perceive this new French citizen as a member of the community. So we ask another question, which was, you think the other see you as French? And the answer is here. You see that for a large number of not only immigrants, but also for their children who are French by almost by birth, there is no wonder that they're not perceived as French. Almost 65% of the sub-Saharan African say that they are not perceived as French. Well, they're perceived as black, basically. And it seems that being perceived as black is in contradiction as being perceived as French. So if you group together the different ethnic backgrounds and you reduce them to, type of ethno-racial groups, the Europeans, the blacks, the Malians, blacks include the overseas, the members from the overseas department, the French from the overseas department, who are French for almost five centuries. So it's not related to migration itself, it's a sort of internal migration. And migrations on Asians, you see that those who feel French and are not perceived as French, this is what the statistic is giving, is pretty high. For almost a third of these groups, they do feel French, and they say, well, but I'm not perceived as such. So this dissonance between their self-perception and their experience in the real life, in the society, is pretty high. And it creates clearly the conditions for not being accepted inside the national community. So I will conclude on that. And you see these different curves say two things. The first graph above is a question about how often are you asked about your ethnic background in your everyday life. So it means how often are you perceived. Maybe it's not negative or positive, it's simply a sort of a concrete situation of being perceived as different. And so what you see here is the distribution among these pseudo-ethno-racial groups that I mentioned before, and the evolution through generations, so immigrants, generation 1.5 to 2.5, okay? And what you see is that for the Europeans, there is a sharp decline of not being, of being asked about their origin at the first generation. So very quickly, they are not perceived as different. As for the blacks, those who come from Sub-Saharan Africa or from the Caribbean islands, it's remained absolutely steady across the generation. That means even at the generation 2.5, they are still perceived as different than when they just arrived. So there is not a decline of this othering across the generation. So the second graph tells you something different. It's this question about are you perceived as French? And when they say that, well, they are more perceived as French when they are belonging to the generation 2.5 than when they just arrived. But still, for those who are blacks or those who are Maghrebians, not being perceived as French is still a situation for 20% of them when they are generation 2.5. So it seems that there is still an ongoing process of not being included in the national community. So my conclusion, and I've been long, is that even though there are the rise of native identities in the French society, which is a society which not created an avenue for that, contrasting with the American society in which having a national identity is a way to be part of the American community, in the case of France, and it could be say as well for the case of Germany or Italy or the Netherlands, being a dual something is not being a real member of the society. So the expectation mainly is that you should leave aside your own belongings, your former belongings, and move to the national belonging instead of combining these affiliations. The second information that we got here is that it seems that the French citizenship is not really a civic one based on political participation and legal participation to this citizenship, but it is also a racial one. Those who look the more different, are not accepted as members, full members of the society. And, of course, it's only a matter of belonging in the data that I presented, but we got exactly the same information when it comes to discrimination, access to labor market, housing, segregation. So it seems that there is a sort of trend of racialization of the position of the members of the French society, which was not foreseen before.
Thank you very much, Patrick. These are worrisome trends. We used to think that, you know, the Atlantic actually separated us from Europe, and many of us have argued that we're beginning to look more and more one like the other. And I think that for all these years, for so many people who said, you know, those things don't happen in France. Those things don't happen in France. I used to testify up on the Hill. And, you know, there would be actually Americans who thought they had understood France who would argue discrimination. Of course, there's no discrimination. Not in France. You know, once you become French, that's it. You know, you're French. And for me, there is a certain predictability to this and a certain sadness to see, you know, all of these pathologies, as it were, play themselves out so vividly in France. And we haven't even talked about the politics of this, which we're going to get to later on. Now, Katz has studied for much of his professional life, has looked at the reaction to immigration across Europe, and he has some interesting, funny, and compelling slides. So it's going to be a presentation of a different nature, but I suspect we are all going to get very similar messages about what's going on in Europe in that regard.
Thank you. What I focus on is, in a sense, the response to immigration, and more specifically, the negative response to immigration, which can be called term nativism, even though it's a very distinct Anglo-Saxon term, which doesn't have any equivalent in any other language. But by and large, what it means is anti-immigrant movements, although nativists by and large define their state as the political unit of their cultural, you know, their nation. And they consider anyone who is not from that nation as a threat. Now, in Western Europe, that's mostly immigrants. In Eastern Europe, where immigration is still very low, the alien is often an indigenous other, most importantly the Roma, Gypsy, sometimes an ethnic group of a bordering country. Now, although their success is different, and for example, immigration does not explain the success of nativist parties in Eastern Europe, they are similar parties and work with similar ideologies. And what I want to do is go very quickly through their main ideology, particularly how it links to immigration, and then show you their relevance. And I think it's important to not overstate the case. Now, if you would all have sat or sit here and I believe that you all thought that the radical right or nativist parties were completely irrelevant, I would have told you that they're more important than you think. But I feel that I'm in an audience that actually thinks that they're more important than they are, and therefore I will be the devil's advocate. So first of all, what are we talking about? When we talk about nativist parties, or what is more usually called radical right parties, and these are some of the logos of the parties, they have three key ideological features. And as I said, the first one is nativism. And it's a combination of nationalism and xenophobia. So what it means is you believe that the Dutch state is the state of the Dutch nation, and any non-Dutch people are threatening. Or France is a French nation, any non-French are threatening the state. Now, it's not just people, it can also be ideas. So within nativist parties, radical right parties, Americanization is considered very threatening. Now, it's not that they're worried that they're being swamped by millions of American immigrants, but they're worried about the effects of whatever, hip-hop music or McDonald's or anything else, something that is not native on their culture. So these are some of the posters and slogans. And what you see is that most of the time that fear of the alien is expressed in two ways, and they're very closely connected. One is economic. They're expensive. But as we have it here in the U.S., we have on the one hand they take our jobs, and on the other hand they take our benefits because they don't work. Like that, there's no problem having that even in one sentence. The idea is that they threaten our livelihood. Now within the European context, which is very different from the U.S., though not necessarily from Canada, the welfare state plays a very big role. Now the welfare state in much of Europe is very large and well-developed and very popular. Radical right parties are not neoliberal parties. They actually support the welfare state. but they want to limit the welfare state to their own nation. Right? And so what you often see is they're not just a threat to their jobs, but they're a threat to their pensions or to their benefits and those kind of things. And so Front National, for example, they're stating that it costs France 60 billion money, 60 billion euros for the immigration. What you see more and more is a pure cultural discourse, and that you see in the top, where it's from a German radical right party, and the slogan says Berlin 2030, it goes quicker than you think. No, radical right is not overly subtle, so it's pretty clear what the message is, right? Islamization. Now, the Islamization debate is new. It's not completely new, because some parties already used it in the 80s, but much of the 80s and 90s, nativism was expressed in purely ethnic cultural terms. The enemy was a Turk in Germany or in the Netherlands or in Belgium. That enemy has become a Muslim. And that is actually not just a word. The change, the narrative, also has major consequences of what the threat is. And to a certain extent, the way you define the other has a consequence of how you define yourself. Right? And so it has led to a different kind of discourse. Muslims are first and foremost seen as threatening, not for economic reasons, not even necessarily for making us, the in-group, different, but more in a kind of an imperialist sense. Islamophobia within nativist forces in Europe is about Muslims as the fifth colony of a larger global movement. It is about an essential struggle, not necessarily about culture, but also about democracy. So you have radical right parties who have never cared about gender equality in their life, who are now the biggest defenders of gender equality against Muslims. Right? And so they create a very conservative image of where Muslims are dominating their women or not giving them equal rights. And they say, we're against that, not out of some kind of nationalist argument, but because we are good progressive Democrats. They won't say progressive, but they will say Democrats. Gay rights at times are defended, particularly in northern countries like the Netherlands. It always fascinates many Americans as well as southern European students of mine that you can have a Dutch radical right party which defends gay rights. That's absolutely not a bizarre issue for the Dutch. For a politician like Geert Wilders, who's the main radical right politician in the Netherlands, gay rights are a fundamental part of Dutch culture. And that is threatened by Islam. And then you have separation of state and church. The key point is that by shifting the enemy from purely ethnic cultural terms to ethno-religious terms, so from the Turk to the Muslim, the debate has widened and the coalition has broadened. The ethno-cultural discourse of the Turk was only attractive for a nationalist audience. The Muslim can be outcasted on the basis of secular arguments, namely being a religious threat to a secular country, as well as security arguments, 9/11 link. And that makes it more acceptable to mainstream discourses, which in many countries do not accept overly nationalist. So nativism is big, and anti-immigration is one of the key things that you will see. Now, the other thing is authoritarianism. These are law and order parties. However, law and order is almost always linked to immigration. And a very good example are these two posters. The left one is a classic one from the Swiss People's Party, and it actually says creating security. So clearly, if the white people kick out the black people or the white sheep kick out the black sheep, right, you get security. Right? So you see there that nativism and authoritarianism are one. on the right is Geert Wilders, the Dutch politician who says more security, less immigration. Exactly the same. Right? So the law and order discourse has a very strong anti-immigrant aspect to it. Finally, there is populism, and populism in the way that society is seen as being divided between two groups, a pure people who are homogenous and a corrupt elite who are homogenous. Now, the radical right is the voice of the people, as this poster of Marine Le Pen says. She speaks for all the good people. All the other parties are part of that one corrupt elite, which the poster under that with the monkey. The monkeys are actually the Christian Democrats, the Liberals, and the Socialists. These are the three main parties in Flanders, in Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. The point is that the Front National uses the term Gang of Four, or used that term. The point is that the regular political distinctions that we normally talk about, Democrats versus Republicans, or like Labour versus Conservatives, are denied. They say, by the way, that's all kind of a play. Because in the end, they're all elite, and they're all together, and they're all corrupt. Against all these other parties, there's only one party that actually is the party of the people. That is us. And what is good for, like, whatever Marine Le Pen says, is good for all people. Because class divisions or other divisions are really just constructs from bad elite. Right? Now, this ties to immigration in the way that most of the nativist parties will say, well, all these type of parties, they're all responsible for making us multicultural. Right? And they have brought in the immigrants to either for big business, cheap labor, or the socialists have supported it because they could bring them into their electorate. So you get this whole conspiracy theory where immigration is linked to the mainstream parties. And for example, Geert Wilders will refer to the Party of Labor as the Party of Immigrants. And his argument is that while Labor doesn't care about the white working class, it cares about immigrants. Now, in the end, there is an ideological threat here. But it's important to remember that radical right parties are not the same as the extreme right of the 1930s. Like, Le Pen is not Hitler. Contemporary parties do accept democracy in the sense of popular sovereignty and majority rule. They do not want to have a dictator. But they do not accept liberal democracy. Most importantly, they do not accept pluralism, and they do not accept the politics of compromise. And the reason is that they see the key groups as being homogenous. The nation, everyone within the nation is the same. Divisions within that are artificial. Divisions within the people are artificial. So pluralism is rejected, but also compromise is rejected. If you're the pure people and you compromise with the corrupt elite, you will be corrupted. Right? So you cannot make a compromise. And importantly, minority rights consequently are seen as special interests, which are by definition undemocratic. Right? So the radical right today doesn't want to overthrow democracy. It doesn't want to institute a new Führer. But it does want to take away some of the foundations of liberal democracy, which are constitutional protection of minority rights. So these are the electoral results of the parties. And this points in the west and the east of Europe. Let me give you a quick reading of what this means. First of all, you have to keep in mind that virtually no country in Europe is a two-party system like here. That means that a party that has between 20 and 30% is often the largest party or the largest opposition party. That said, most of the radical right parties are actually way below 20%. Now you see there the high score, that means the highest score they ever achieved in elections since 1980. On the right, you see the scores that they got in the last election. There are two things very important. Virtually no party got their highest score in the latest election. Now, this is very important given the discourse that we have. And the discourse that we have is economic crisis leads to the rise of political extremism. Right? Actually, when you look at it empirically, it does not. Since the crisis started in 2008, the radical right has not done better than at other times. Some radical right parties have, others have not. And the reason why I emphasize it is because if you want to understand the success as well as the effect of radical right parties, the national context is incredibly important. What happens in Greece today is not necessarily going to happen anywhere else in Europe because there are very specific conditions there. These are about 25 countries. Now there are about 50 European countries. Only in half of the European countries are radical right parties more or less valid. In all the countries that are not here, the radical right has not gained pretty much over 2% in national elections. Right? Of these, I would say about a quarter of the countries have a radical right party that is sometimes in government or is the main opposition party. It's not to say that they're not important. It's just to say that they're not important everywhere at any time. Now, that goes to the political influence. This is the government participation of radical right parties in Europe since 1980. They have been in about 20 governments, a little bit more. However, in that period, there have been probably about 400 governments. Right? So, roughly 2 to 5% of all governments in Europe have a radical right party. Of those, the radical right is always the junior partner. That means they're governing with another party which is larger and which is not radical right. It tends to be a mainstream right-wing party. So that already should warn us about not expecting too much of it. Radical right parties do not dominate European politics. And if you look at the direct influence of what type of laws radical right parties have made, they of course have made very few because they're almost never in government. And virtually all laws are made by government parties. Once they do make laws, they tend to be laws that tighten immigration, make integration more difficult, more law and order, and generally more Eurosceptic, which means that they're less positive towards the European Union. Also, when they're in government, it tends to lead to polarization of the political sphere, which comes, of course, from both sides. The most interesting thing is virtually all European countries have tightened immigration, have strengthened integration, have had more law and order, and by and large are slightly more Eurosceptic. Right? So whatever we see in countries where the radical right is in government or is very large in parliament, we see roughly the same things in countries where they're not in parliament. Germany is a good example. Britain is a good example. Both countries have very small radical right parties, yet have tightened immigration over the last 20 years, have influenced or implemented law and order policy. Now, on the right is indirect influence, and that is the most difficult thing. A lot of policies are influenced by a lot of different actors. But it's very difficult to see who did what. Right? So whenever the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats in Germany introduce tightened immigration, they're not going to say, oh, we do that because of the radical right. But they might. But they might also do that because the tabloids go on and on about immigration being a major issue. Or because actually 60% of Germans think that there's too much immigration. The point is that whether or not there is a radical right party, virtually every European country has a very large support for the main positions of the radical right. And so when you have a large plurality or a small majority of people who think that you should have tougher law and order, you should have less immigration, you should have a more independent stance towards Europe, someone is going to pick that up. If it isn't the radical right, then it will most of the time be a mainstream right wing.
Thanks. thank you very much, Kat, and thank you for these very, very interesting slides. You know, I don't know where you find all of the sushis and all that and how you put them all together.
That was
cool. They certainly do. Yeah, I know that. My colleagues always tell me that. So, Charles, have you heard, what have you heard that strikes you as most similar to what's going on here and most dissimilar as to what's been going on here?
Thank you, Dimitri. And I want to commend both papers. I also want to especially commend the fact that, Dimitri, you didn't require either Frank or me to do a paper. So we can just say whatever we want. You know, my first reaction is sort of welcome to my world, right? But I do want to note a couple of things about the papers that I think are important. You know, there is in many respects, a deeper attempt to apply some, you know, traditional social science research principles and a degree of rigor to the study of what's happening in Europe than, frankly, we often see on this side of the Atlantic. You know, at least particularly recently, there was a lot of social science research around race and immigration, maybe a couple of decades ago, and my sense is there is less of that going on. Kat, I noted in your paper, you seem to be looking at what's happening in the U.S., you were not just relying on social science research. You were going out and collecting a fair amount of data yourself, for example, on incidents of hate crimes or deaths attributable to concerns about race or nativism. You know, and I commend it because these are devilishly complex issues. These are hard to measure because one of the things that people very often mislead, I think, both themselves and pollsters or social scientists are on these very questions. Very few people will admit that a social scientist or a pollster that, yes, you know, I'm a racist. You know, causality, particularly on this side of the Atlantic, I think is terribly difficult. You've got the whole question of immigration policy and the changing nature of the immigrant stream. You have questions of race, which I think are pretty fundamental in this country, and I think very hard to disentangle from nativism. And even in the context of large Mexican migration or large Latino migration, you also have the fact that there were significant numbers of Latinos, of Americans of Hispanic descent, who became citizens by conquest, and in fact were viewed, I think, not terribly dissimilarly from, say, colonial folks in Europe. You have, I think, complicated questions of geography. One could argue that the Alabama law might have been stimulated by the rapid growth of immigrants in Alabama. I think there's some truth to that. But frankly, we see a fair amount of nativism in places where there are virtually no immigrants, and my sense is they're getting a feeling about demographic change from the media, and particularly as the media has become increasingly polarized. I think you can find reinforcement for whatever preconceptions and, frankly, prejudices everywhere that you want. You know, it's also, I think, complicated because questions of race and nativism involve the interaction of both how people view themselves and how they are viewed by others, and both of those actually have a fair amount of interaction, so that if, and we have a pretty strong evidence of how this plays out in the case of race. We know, for example, that if you hold people in slavery for 100 years and then segregate them for another 100, lo and behold, a couple of 100 years later, they're going to face considerable socioeconomic disadvantages. And if you are so inclined, you can then point to those very disadvantages and argue that therefore this is a, these people are inferior. Look, they are less educated, don't work as hard, they're not as well prepared, they're on welfare, whatever, and, you know, while completely disregarding the previous history. And like anything else, these are matters that are frequently affected by, you know, sort of one-time big events like 9/11, but I believe also by, if not immediate economic consequences, I believe your observation that you can't find real close correlations between anti-immigrant policy action and economic recession. I do believe that long-term economic trends make a big difference. So in this country, it seems to me that the growing inequality, sort of the long-term middle class squeeze that has been taking place over the course of at least three decades provides some fertile ground for growth in nativism and anti-immigrant sentiment. I do, notwithstanding the fact that I would commend all three papers to everyone, I do have some quibbles. One, in Kass's paper is the assumption that in the U.S. there is, quote-unquote, no significant nativist party. And a similar observation that there are relatively few examples of direct policy or electoral impact by explicitly or predominantly nativist parties. I think this severely understates the impact of nativists in the U.S. And it seems to me, going off of the very last slide and point that Kass was making, you know, the most significant impact is not, it seems to me, both in Europe and the United States, is not necessarily that there would be an explicitly nativist or explicitly racist party that has a direct effect in terms of public policy formation, but the fact is, these have enormous effects on the mainstream political party. So that we've, I think, discernibly seen Republicans move towards restrictionism in the last decade, and I believe also much more intolerant rhetoric, and I think that is based at least in part on the growth of what I will later argue is a quasi-nativist political party. And given the importance of the Hispanic vote to Democrats, to at least some, and certainly to me, it's surprising how potent restrictionism as a force continues to be among some elements of the Democratic Party. And while it's not a formal political party, I think the Tea Party and its allies has had undeniable electoral success, contributing to the defeat of significant numbers of pro-immigrant Republicans, or the Republican centrists. And I think it has predictably led others who have not been defeated towards significantly changing their positions with respect to immigration policy. It is, and finally, I just do want to note this point. I think both copies of the paper noted it. And it's the importance of public opinion writ large. You know, political success, I think, does shape public opinion to the extent that it, to the extent restrictionism gains more political power in the country, I think it also starts to shape the public discourse. And so you have, you know, increased tolerance of intolerance. That tends to reinforce itself. So in turn, that encourages some who might otherwise remain silent to speak out and act, and that in turn creates some adds to their political power. And I think we saw some of that in the really quite broad, widespread grassroots opposition to comprehensive immigration reform in the Senate in 2007. With respect to Patrick's paper, I think it feels to me like it takes much too optimistic a view of this country's acceptance of multiculturalism. You know, maybe this might be true in comparison to Europe. I don't know a lot about Europe, frankly. But it feels to me in this country, to the extent it is successful, contextual, highly contextual, and really paradoxical. So as an example, one could argue that there's a seeming acceptance of multilingualism, whether that's a ATM offered in multiple languages, or at least for a couple more election cycles, bilingual ballots, hopefully we'll find in stores. But it is also true that every one of those things is remarkably unpopular. So as they're becoming ubiquitous, it feels to me, at least according to the public opinion polls, that they are getting increasingly unpopular and more of a flashpoint. Another obvious example is the paradox of having a black president with, at the same time, largely unchanged indicators of social acceptance of African Americans, at least for public people. With respect to remedies, and with Dimitri's overview includes, I think, something that is central, and that is whether it's nativism or racism or combating straightforward civil rights, anti-discrimination policies are clearly part of the solution. That shouldn't be a surprise when I come from a civil rights organization. One thing I think we've learned over 4 decades now with civil rights law enforcement in this country, however, is that these things are easy for us to support as a country in principle, and terribly difficult to enforce in practice. And I'm happy to elaborate on that point if we have time. Finally, with regard to all three papers, it seems to me there is a real focus on state actors, and I think that makes a lot of sense. For Frank and me, we're a lot more concerned about what is the, civil society's response and what is our strategy, in short. Let me just offer maybe three things we ought to consider. And one, I suspect Frank agrees with, even though we've been grappling with this problem, I think without a clear solution for some time, we need a different story to tell that I think is more modern and reflects the current state of American society. We had a civil rights story and a movement with a clear story based on race and the need for basic civil rights laws. For a time, immigration advocates had a very clear story about pushing back on restrictionism, and we came close, having that story be enough to stimulate reform. But I think on both counts, civil rights and immigration advocates need a new story that is somehow encompasses both why we need immigration reform, but arguably more importantly, why demographic change in this post-civil rights environment is a good thing for this country. And I haven't seen, despite the fact, and certainly I haven't come up with the fact that even though at least my organization tries to live in both the civil rights and the immigration advocacy world, I don't think we've quite figured out how to bring those two stories together. And in terms of how do we know it's going to be successful, I think it's a high standard. I think what we're facing is the need to respond to what has been really 2 decades of a very successful, maybe 3 decades of a very successful anti-political correctness movement. So somehow in the 90s, the right frankly completely turned the tables on us, focusing on excesses in the academy and elsewhere, lumping multiple policies, affirmative action, gay rights, immigrants' rights, women's rights, into a sort of a single pejorative label, maybe highly associated with elite. And frankly have successfully used that to discredit not just many of our arguments, but many of us. Even though we like to think of ourselves as mainstream and nativists and those folks as fringe, I'm not sure that electoral or policy results prove that point. A second element, it seems to me, is a real renewed focus on elite opinion. And, you know, many of us learning the lessons of 2007 and other policy battles have focused a lot on base building, and clearly we need some of that. But as I've seen the politics become more and more polarized, and really, again, building on Hans's last point about, you know, the need for compromise, and the nativists in Europe's opposition to compromise is something you know, sort of fundamentally inimical to their interests, it seems to me we have a fundamental interest if we're ever going to get centrist Republicans again in this country, that we need a way to appeal to them and to help we redraw the lines of acceptable public discourse to really protect a bipartisan center, at least on issues of both immigration and race, which at one time and in the not-so-distant past existed on both issues, and feels to me has disappeared virtually completely now. And finally, I would just note that, you know, facts on the ground matter, and they matter a lot, probably more than, you know, Spinmeisters and advocates like us. Sorry to use my, every time I have something pejorative to say about myself, I'm going to include Frank as well. And so I think we do need stronger and more explicit strategies to demonstrate and really accelerate the facts on the ground that show Americans and often skeptical Americans that a pluralistic, multiculturalist society can actually work, can work well, and for all Americans and not just us. And I think the fact, you know, one of the successes we've had in recent years has been the really powerful stories that Dreamers have been able to tell. And I think part of the power is that they're undeniably American kids. And so we didn't have to actually go out and make the case that assimilation or acculturation or Americanization or integration, whatever term you want to use, has worked with these kids. It's undeniable in, you know, every single sentence they speak. You know, the immigrant integration work that I think all the speakers have talked about and MPI worked so hard on is critical and is going to be increasingly difficult at a time of state budget cuts and probably federal budget cuts. You know, it feels to me that we may need, along those lines, to pursue some more universalist touch strategies, and you know, maybe we ought to be focusing on adult literacy writ large, and maybe not staying in our ESL box. You know, maybe we ought to be focusing a little bit more on you know, universal pre-K rather than focusing, as certainly Nancy Lark has done and others, on sort of pre-K for ELLs and or English language learners and others. And over the long term, you know, if we really aren't able to make the pie bigger, that is to say, and who knows what's going to happen economically, but if we are going to continue to have or be unable to make substantial progress on reversing decades of income inequality and having more and more Americans facing, you know, a situation where they can't be confident that their kids are going to be better off than they are, then going back to my point about facts on the ground, you know, I think we ought to at least consider, for the sake of a body, a healthier society, better attitudes on race, and a more accepting immigration policy, whether we ought to take a look at whether slowing the pace of immigration to this country writ large, hopefully following some sort of comprehensive immigration reform might not be part of the solution. You know, that may well be heretical, but I think Dimitri's paper makes a very powerful point that it doesn't seem like the necessarily the size of an of foreign born population has a lot of correlation with anti-immigrant policies, either here or in Europe. But it seems there's an almost one-to-one correlation between the pace of immigration and anti-immigrant policy. So that's hopefully something relatively controversial for all of us.
Thank you very much, Charles, for these extremely thoughtful remarks. And I apologize again that you're so diligent that you felt obliged to actually read the papers.
I just read the
executive. Oh, I see. And Frank, I asked Frank, I should also say that Charles is also a fellow in residence here for a year because he's writing what I think is going to become not only the best book, but a compelling book on the struggles of the 1980s. Leading to the immigration legislation in 1986, but more to the point, the evolution of this sort of group of organizations, civil rights organizations, and how they adopted immigration as one of their key issues, and how they grew and expanded their influence and worked even more closely together in doing so during the 1980s and beyond. So we're grateful.
I appreciate the plug. It would be more accurate to say that I'm allegedly
wrong. Well, I just want you to know that this has been live streamed, so some of your funders, you know, may want to actually not know.
I'm trying really hard.
Okay. So Frank has been this issue from the inside, the outside, the, you know, upside down, and from every possible side. I asked Frank to talk to us a little bit and take the conversation really local, outside of Washington, you know. How has the issue morphed into these horrible kinds of ideas that have taken hold of certain states? And if you can build into some of the history of these issues, perhaps bring in the race part into the conversation. And, of course, say anything else that you feel like saying.
Sure. I, too, want to thank you for not making us write a paper. The last one I wrote, I think, was in college, but I'm not for sure. And I did read the papers. I read them thoroughly, but it was really tough to get through them because anything more than an 800-word op-ed is heavy lifting for me. But let me say, it's really interesting to sort of step back and think about. I'm so pasted up against the daily war that I've been in on immigration for the last 30 years that to actually step back and try to look at factors and elements and gain some perspective on it is really quite challenging. But I'm going to, you know, make some observations based on as a warrior. The other thing that I just want to mention is that for the past 5 or 6 years, I've been going to Europe a couple of times a year working with NGOs over there. So I don't claim any particular expertise, but that's never stopped me from venturing strongly held opinions. So I'll be making a few comments that really aim to provoke our European friends, like, what are the similarities and differences in the dynamics in our future? Because in my own view is that the dynamics of the debate, I do a lot of training with NGOs. The dynamics of the nativist challenge in both countries, the nature of it is very similar, right? The discourse is similar. The elites are out to screw you. The immigrants aren't like us. They're threatening our identity and culture, whether it's respect for gay rights in the Netherlands or respect for the English language in America. It's a threat to who we are. They're the other. And then, of course, the resources discourse about they're taking jobs and using taxes. I mean, it's remarkably similar. But the political context in which these debates take place, the kind of underlying, some of the underlying value systems are a bit different. And more, I think the political frame through which this is happening
sort of on different timelines or different times in history, if you will. And so I hear more for the European future right now than I do the American, interestingly, because even though the debate has gotten incredibly ugly in America, and we are at a moment of truth, and if the election goes a certain way, we could have an advent of federal restriction of policy like we've never seen, I'm still optimistic, strangely optimistic, and I'll say why in a minute. But the wars on immigration really, you know, in the 1980s, you know, I was working locally, but we weren't engaged in the debate that much. It was more, you know, commissions and Washington players that were really driving the debate. And then in the 90s, there was the advent, if you will, of the kind of populist nativist backlash really, you know, started in California in 1994 with Proposition 187, a ballot measure. I went out and worked on the campaign, and I could not believe the kind of racial animosity, political polarization. I mean, all of the TV debates were the two spokespeople, and I worked on one of the campaigns, yelling at each other nonstop. I mean, forget Jim Lehrer losing control of the debate. Two people screaming at each other, and that was how emotional it was. And then working in Arizona from time to time as the anti-immigrant movement got stronger there, and then we did a lot of work recently in Alabama, where really the harshest law in recent history was passed and implemented. A federal judge stupidly let it go into effect, and creating an incredible real-life laboratory experiment of what self-deportation or attrition to enforcement will look like if it spreads to other states. So in looking at the way the debate has evolved, I mean, when I look at the local explosions, if you will, or debates, there does seem to be common factors. And I actually think these may relate to Europe, but I'll let our European colleagues respond to that. So the pace of change, of demographic change, is definitely a factor. In my observation, it's not an empirical statement, it's based on experience, combined with the sense that nobody's minding the store. That creates a public anxiety that is ripe for political exploitation. So whether it was Pete Wilson picking up the nativist rhetoric in California and riding the reelection in his gubernatorial campaign in 1994, hoping to set himself up to run for president in 1996. He literally thought it was going to catapult him to the presidency, right? Or, you know, Jan Brewer winning re-election by signing SB 1070 in Arizona that Russell Pierce, the de facto governor at the time, really put into effect. I mean, the fact is that you've got these political opportunists who work with local nativists and national groups that strategically come in and add money and expertise and really take advantage of a situation. Normally, you know, why isn't there more of an initial response? Because it's done at a time when the immigrant community is too new, not well enough organized, don't have great allies yet lined up. And so the civil society response is usually an angry but weak response from a poorly organized immigrant community, and the mainstream is so freaked out by the emotional tenor of the debate that at first they hold back, but then start to get involved. And so that's what's happened in many of these places that we've been involved in. Now I'm speaking of situations where we're talking about undocumented immigrants or illegal immigration, and mainly Latino immigrants in these states. But these same dynamics have played out in other situations. And don't forget the Vietnamese in the Gulf Coast in the late 70s or the Cubans in Miami. The first English-only law was introduced in Dade County by Orrin Hatch's cousin, right, Charles? And the guys who organized against it, one of them became the mayor of Miami, right? So what the Cuban-American community did was went from being an exile community with their eyes on Cuba to essentially dominating South Florida politics. And it was in response to that nativist challenge. You have, you know, Kurds in Tennessee and Somalis in Minnesota, et cetera. So it's not exclusive to Latino immigrants. And I think these dynamics of the pace of change, a visible minority, if you will, the fact that it's ripe for exploitation, the community's weak, and it takes a while. The reason that I'm more encouraged is what I call the backlash to the backlash. I mean, in California, what happened is that Pete Wilson didn't become
the President of the United States. In fact, California transformed politically from a state that had elected Republican governors for most of the previous 25 years to a blue state where the only statewide official candidate who could win was Arnold Schwarzenegger in a special election because he didn't have to run in the primary. Meaning it's become a blue state dominated by a Democratic candidate, and the main reason is the Latino and Asian vote that has become so dominant in the country. Jerry Brown, running for governor in California, lost the white vote and won easily. Not unlike the fact that Barack Obama may not get 40% of the white vote in this election and could still win re-election. So that California response of getting politically organized, of becoming mainstream as well as having a strong base, I think is instructive. I think Arizona is in transition. Now, you know, almost definitely Arizona is going to vote for Romney because the demographics still favor the white majority against the growing, Obama-type coalition of Latinos, African-Americans, Asians, and progressive whites. The demographics favor, it's still a red state. But I think most people predict that within 2, 4, 6 years, Arizona is going to follow California from red to purple to blue. The demographics are almost inevitable. There's been more of an investment in the voter mobilization infrastructure in Arizona. And so you may see an upset this year, like a Richard Carmona upsetting Jeff Flake in a remarkable race that's closer than anyone expected, in large part because the reaction to the SB 1070 type push means that the Latino community is rising and doesn't plan to take many prisoners. And if you don't think I'm telling the truth, ask Russell Pierce, the de facto governor from just a few years ago. His political career has now ended because of a recall effort, and then he was soundly trounced. And not only trounced because of Latino voters, but also because moderate business folks, moderate Republicans said, enough of this nativist baloney. So very interesting. So I think Arizona is in transition. But talking about a place like Alabama or Georgia or some of the southern states, I don't have much optimism. I don't see much pushback. I don't see a strong enough countervailing force. Yes, there are people in the business community upset. Yes, there's hits to the reputation of those states. But the demographics and the politics favor nativist legislation, and there's a lot of backslapping. We spent a lot of time, after Alabama became a huge national and international story, the legislature said, okay, we're going to revisit this piece of legislation. And we all put a lot of effort into trying to figure out how to make it maybe a significant change. And all the good people who wanted to make a significant change got overwhelmed by the Tea Party types at the last minute, and they made the law worse in the face of international condemnation, threats of boycotts, international auto companies under fire, the state's reputation going down the toilet. They said, yeah, in Alabama, we do it the Alabama way. And I don't see that stopping anytime particularly soon. So I'm not very optimistic there. And in fact, I see that a bit more like Europe. Not to call it Europe, Alabama. Let me take that back. Meaning the dynamics of where's the countervailing political force becomes the question. So, but I am optimistic. Look, I mean, we are on the verge. I do think the Republican Party has become the, you know, pretty much the restrictionist party in the country. The anti-immigrant movement in America has been successful mainly by working low turnout primaries to scare Republicans into adopting a tough position, see Mitt Romney, and that if Mitt Romney gets elected, we could have a very tough 4 years in terms of immigration policy. But I think the wars will be even hotter. I think there will be sort of a confrontational nature to the next 4 years like we haven't seen if it happens. And as even people close to Romney have said publicly, there's no way he could win re-election with pursuing once again what is essentially a whites-only electoral strategy. And then the demographics won't allow it. So we'll see how that would play out. But I'm actually somewhat optimistic that the Latino turnout, in part mobilized by this defining issue, or as Marco Rubio calls it, this gateway issue of immigration, is going to turn out in such a way that it's going to be one of the factors that leads to Obama's re-election. And I think that that is going to be another step forward in the political mobilization where there's a countervailing political force of enough intensity and enough political impact where the nativist movement is going to be actually trumped. I'll give you an example of where something locally that we're working on. The Maryland legislature passed a State Dream Act, which would allow undocumented immigrants in that are Maryland residents whose parents pay taxes to go to Maryland public colleges, starting at the community college level, and with in-state tuition rates. It passed. It was tough to get it passed, but it happened. And then the opponents, the anti-immigrant forces in Maryland, organized in lightning speed a petition, and for one of the first times, Maryland's going to have a referendum, a set of issues on the ballot, and it's to repeal this law. And once they qualified it, the anti-immigrant groups were high-fiving, all we have to do is get on the ballot, we're going to win. Well, right now the polling shows that about 60 to 40% in favor of keeping the Dream Act. I mean, one of the crucibles of highly charged political issues in American politics, see marriage equality, is that you've got to win at the referendum level. And this is going to be, I think, a huge change. So having worked on a number of ballot initiatives where the anti-immigrant movement came in with a lot of money and a lot of leadership to help folks on the ground locally to win and therefore send a message nationally, I think we're going to have just the opposite. This is an example where the pro-immigrant forces have come in strong, the anti-immigrant forces are nowhere to be found, and it's probably going to pass overwhelmingly. Again, I think a sign of a turning point. So I'm optimistic that the political frame of the response, the backlash to the backlash, means that the anti-immigrant movement, with as Dimitri, I steal most of my sound bites from others, and this one comes directly from Dimitri, so I usually use it without having to say that, but since I'm sitting here, I have to say it, that the confluence of politics, demographics, and economics is going to lead to some inevitable policy changes in a more positive pro-immigrant direction. And so I'm confident even if Romney somehow wins this election, that it may take longer, it might be harder, but that's where we're heading. Let me make a few comments about Europe, and it's more by way of question. It seems like the liberal democratic traditions in Europe are being tested by the rise of nativism in a way that, quite frankly, I'm terrified. When I'm working with NGO advocates over there, they can't say they come from a nation of immigrants the way we do in the United States or Canada. They say, well, we believe in human rights, sort of. Right? We're against fascism, yeah, but where's the ethnic vote? Where are the alliances between mainstream constituencies? I have to say, it seems about where we were 15 years ago. And maybe it's just that the debate is newer and that the political response will take about the same time it took in America, hopefully less time. But what I question is that if our key to challenging and competing and maybe getting the upper hand with the nativist movement in the United States is our political strength, I'm wondering if a corresponding political strength will come from ethnic voters and so forth in Europe. That seems unlikely. So that's why without the sort of the same identity as a nation of immigrants where diversity is baked in the cake of national identity and with an ethnic and immigrant vote that isn't strong enough to stand up with its allies to the anti-immigrant traditions. I mean, I'm actually surprised, as I said to both you guys, that it hasn't gotten worse in Europe. And so I'd be interested in why hasn't it gotten worse and can there be a countervailing force or what's the force that's holding it in check now to the extent that it is and could it get much worse? I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Frank, and thank you for the optimism. Optimism, skepticism. I'm lost. I don't know whether you're optimistic or pessimistic. Now, long-term optimist is good. So I know that some questions came to the way of the other panelists, but I will propose the following if you all agree. We have 25 minutes, so why don't we take three questions, a round of three questions from the audience. They may raise some of the issues that some of the other speakers did, or they may put some new ones on the table. And then I will give you a chance to to address some of these questions, and in doing so, you can address some of the questions or comments that came from the other speakers. So there is going to be a microphone that somebody has, that Lisa has. Since this is going to be part of the proceedings, speak into the microphone, but identify yourself first. Thank you.
Thank you. Joy Payton, Center for Applied Linguistics, Washington, D.C. Frank, I want to add to your optimism and see if you agree. I think there's another very optimistic, positive trend that has been invisible and remains pretty invisible, but I think is growing in force, and that is heritage language communities and heritage language programs. We have a similar dynamic here with French as is in France. There are French-speaking immigrants from Haiti and from French-speaking African countries. They're increasingly here. They're in our public schools. When they get here, they're people of color. They're not considered to be French. They often cannot participate in the French programs because those programs are paid for by the European French community, and that's who they're available to. But there are French heritage language programs in New York City, Miami, Maine, and growing, which are giving those kids opportunities to learn French in school. Spanish, which is Spanish-speaking kids often don't want to speak Spanish in school because they're looked down on, dismissed. There's a program at Bailey Crossroads Elementary called Hispanic Leaders Program, where middle school, high school students tutor younger kids, and then they get college credit and so forth. And Nuestra Lengua, these are university programs with communities. And then finally, in California, Seal of Biliteracy, which you probably know about, Frank, Californians tomorrow. And Maryland has adopted the Seal of Biliteracy now. They're going to implement it. So anyway, my question, do you see those as positive trends, and do you think they'll have an impact?
Thank you. Over here, please, Lisa.
I'm Johnny Young from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. My question is for Kat. I'd like to know what NGOs and faith-based organizations are doing in Europe to counter these nativist trends.
Great question, Johnny. Thank you. And one over there.
Thank you. Alan Crowd, American University, and a non-resident fellow of MBI. I want to agree with Frank that, you know, history matters, history counts. And the countries of Europe that I'm going to ask about a question about in a second have a national identity that's deeply tied to homogeneity, racially, homogeneity in religion, homogeneity to a very large extent in language, and so on. The United States fought these battles in the 19th and in the 20th century. We didn't automatically end up a nation of nations, but we became sort of a nation of nations. And nativists in the United States smack hard into a counter-narrative. And the counter-narrative is that we are a nation that welcomes immigrants and has had diversity, not without conflict, not without difficulty at times, but there is this counter-narrative. And I guess what I'm asking, France, after all, has a long history of resistance to diversity, whether you talk about the Dreyfus Affair, the relationship of the gendarmerie to the SS in the Second World War, more recent laws that ban headscarves and yarmulkes from classrooms. Is that narrative changing, and is that narrative changing in other countries in Western Europe to in some way be more embracing of diversity?
Thank you, Alan. So I don't know who wants to go first.
I can begin by this last question about the changing narratives. It's a bit the backlash, not the backlash of the backlash, but the backlash alone by itself, has been quite violent. The change at CUO during the 80s has been a slight move toward more multiculturalism in some European countries. And so the narratives about the homogeneity of the society have been modified somehow. But it has provoked a reaction. And I think you can understand what Cass has shown about these populist and far-right parties in some European countries as a reaction to this new narrative. In the case of the French society, the rise of sensitivity to multiculturalism in the 1982-1983 has been immediately counterbalanced by the rise of the National Front. The first scores nationally of this far-right party has been obtained in 1984, 1 year after what was something like a civil rights movement done by second generation youngs who claim for more equality. 1 year after, you have this upsurge of 10 to 12% in the national, a party which was making only 0.2, 0.3 in national elections. So I think you can understand this polarization that is a sequence of this movement. But it has created a backlash, a real backlash. And the point is, not only far-right parties are supporting this kind of ideas, but the nativist ideas are also supported by mainstream parties from the right and from the left as well. So also the progressists are embracing very critical and adversarial ideas against the autonomy of immigrants in the societies. So in that respect, and I will pronounce on the point of the capacity of mobilization of immigrants. I think one is the striking opposition between most of European countries and the U.S. is the existence of a civil society organized by immigrants or by minorities. I mean, the political system are very good at trying to prevent the emergence of this kind of expression of the civil society according to these ethnic or racial lines. It's accepted that you could mobilize yourself on the basis of political ideologies, but not on the basis of ethnic or racial lines, which means, except now, maybe in the same with the Muslims, who could somehow be a political force, not yet, but there is some sign that give ground to the fact that they could act as political actors in most of European countries. But before that, ethnic groups were never been able to mobilize themselves or to express or to voice any respect because the political system was considering that any voice coming from these kind of groups were not relevant and were infringing the idea of universalism that was at the basis of the progressive democratic state. So this tension has not been resolved. I think that's the biggest difference. And what you said about the U.S. Yet is not, you cannot find any equivalent, except maybe in the U.K., which has, for certain respect, some similarity with the U.S. Or the reverse. Windows.
Can you say something about why the church is not playing a big role in this particular movement?
No, church is playing a big role supporting immigrant movements. I think the church is somehow mediating a bit the main actors for the defense of the undocumented migrants, and beyond that, for the immigrant communities, could be seen as the churches. They are active. Structures that react, but they are not in the position to really change the laws. I think beyond the, the audience of the churches in most of European countries is quite poor.
Right. I think in France in particular, in its Republican sort of.
Yeah. Secularism in France,
right.
The way it is organized less avenue for the churches to be, but they can voice something on the human rights level, but not on the political one.
Okay. Just a couple of the key points.
Let me just make
an observation about the difference between the U.S. And Europe in this debate, because I think there are a couple of important differences at all types of levels that have an important consequence. So first of all, you have a different type of migrant. The vast majority of immigrants here are Hispanic, who are also Catholic, which doesn't confront one of the key tenets of society, which is the religion. The vast majority, although it depends a little bit on the country, in Europe are non-Western, and in many countries they're Muslim. That plays a role in how the debate forms and how the coalitions are, alliances. At the nativist response, there's a big difference that in Europe, it's parties. Actually, there are very few relevant non-party nativist organizations. Because of the political system, the electoral system, they can mobilize electorally. And so the English Defense League, finally, is one of the few street movements that mobilizes. You don't need to lobby because you have your own party. That makes it, on the one hand, way more visible, but perhaps also overstates their power. Because actually, most of these parties for a very long time were outsiders and very badly connected to the mainstreams of power. Now, here in the U.S., because of the two-party system and all kind of other elements to that, nativists mobilize in NGOs and in lobby groups. They're much more difficult to study and particularly to see their influence, but many of them are very well connected within parts of the power structure, most notably the GOP, but not exclusively. If you go, of course, in such a federal state where a lot of power is below the central level, which is often not the case in Europe, it becomes even more difficult. And so in certain states, nativist forces are probably in the U.S. more powerful than in certain countries. However, we can say in that country they have 15% of the vote. Here, it seems as if they have no vote. So I think you see sometimes too much in Europe and too little in the U.S. Finally, the political struggle, as has just been said, one of the key differences is that you don't have a pro-immigrant group. And most importantly, you don't have an immigrant voice in Europe. Now, the key reason for that is that the immigrant population is much more diverse. With the probable exception of Germany, where the largest group was Turkish for a very long time, fairly homogenous, most other countries have pluralities, which were divided over national court, in national camps, and although the native population would think that they were all the same, a Turk and a Moroccan are not going to sit together and fight for the same thing. So the immigrant population is very divided, and that keeps them from having a voice. The other thing is the business community, which is very important here in pro-immigration, is not a very big voice for immigration in Europe, although it's changed in the last couple of years. Personally, I think that has to do with the welfare state that's left to be gained from that. Now, with regard to NGOs and faith-based groups, I think Patrick said most of it. They have been particularly important within the undocumented, the struggle for the undocumented, the sans-papier in France, but also in the Netherlands. But, of course, we're speaking about largely secular countries in many cases, which means that, A, churches are much less important at the local level, and they're way less important at the national level. They just don't have the same force. The other thing is, now with the shift from ethnocultural to ethno-religious, we're no longer dealing with a non-identified immigrant in terms of religious terms. We're talking about Muslims. And this has led to division. So, for example, the Catholic Church in the U.S. comes out pretty strongly in favor of immigration, which is largely Catholic. Within Europe, in various parts, the Catholic Church is pretty worried about immigration, which is predominantly Muslim. Among the Orthodox Protestant are incredible Islamophobia. Right, so the fact that the groups are different has an effect also on the NGOs and faith-based. The other thing is we have a corporate structure more or less in many countries, which means that people don't get their power by mobilizing in the street, but by being integrated into policy networks. A lot of NGOs are included in those policy networks. I guess that they have a voice, but they're very much the voice of the immigrant, which is a weak voice because they consider to speak only for a minority. Now, I want to have some optimism. I'm not an optimism guy generally, but I polarize. And so I actually think there have been important changes which are missed. First of all, we have moved from an immigration to an integration debate. Now, part of that is because there is no immigration anymore, right? And so you can see that as negative. But even the radical right today, right, has grudgingly accepted that these people are here to stay. And so now, rather than talking about repatriation and kicking them out, they're talking about how can we make them as close to us as possible. Definitely not the end stage where you want to be, but it is a very important difference. They are now, for better or for worse, part of the country. The second thing is, and again, it is, I admit there are small prices here, but the shift from an ethno-cultural to a mostly ethno-religious identity has actually worked out pretty well for some minorities. So, for example, the non-Muslim immigrants are off the hook. When I grew up in the Netherlands, one of the worst things was black or Surinamese, which is one of the colonies of the Dutch. That was the other. Right. Surinamese are completely okay today because they're not Muslim. Right? So they have now become part of the Nativist Party, and actually some Surinamese and Antillians are on the Nativist Party's list. Right? So they're small steps, I agree, but they're steps forward.
Wow. Okay. Frank, perhaps you can say a word or two, and then, because I do have a bit of an agenda.
Sure. I think what you're talking about is, particularly in areas where there's lots of immigrants, the transformations that are happening from the bottom up are all over the place. I mean, Dimitri's organization, Migration Policy Institute, has this terrific program called E Pluribus Unum, which highlights innovative local efforts around the country. And the prize winners are unbelievably creative and innovative. There's so much great work done. These kind of, unheralded champions of immigrant integration in America who operate oftentimes in either big institutions that don't care or on, trying to turn a dime into a dollar. It's remarkable. So I have a lot of optimism in the areas where immigrants are who they find in the classroom or in the clinic or in the neighborhood and what people are doing. And so I do think there's this immigrants as assets narrative that's coming back. And I think you see it at an elite level. You see Tom Friedman banging the drum and Mayor Bloomberg and even Rupert Murdoch has gotten with the program. So I just think that, and you see it reflected in public opinion, the public opinion on attitudes towards immigration, even at a time of an economic downturn, have gotten more positive in recent years. It's kind of a remarkable thing. So I think some of those tectonic plates are shifting somewhat positively. And again, I do think the political discourse matters. I mean, Ed Gillespie, who now works for Romney, but before he went in, said something that's very telling. He's one of those smart Republicans who gets it. He said, if the same percentage of Latinos, Asians, and African Americans that voted for John McCain in 2008 vote for the Republican nominee in 2020, he'll lose by 14 points. He or she will lose by 14 points. The point is that the demography of America, this was the year in which more so-called minorities were born than so-called white majority. And so this transformation is inevitable. Now, the pace of it and how it develops is unknown. But the idea of a party that relies on mainly white votes to win elective office is kind of up against the demographic transformation that you're just going to have to reckon with. And they will, if they want to win. And I think that at that level, too, you're going to see
a real shift in the narrative around immigrants and minorities because of political necessity.
Thank you. Charles?
So for the glass half empty response to that.
I wanted us to finish in a very positive note.
I don't think I have a longer point. I guess I would just make two observations. One, yes, Elizabeth, there's lots of those language programs. It's also true that Latino studies programs are political issues in the Southwest, and there are states like Arizona that have banned them, and there are localities in Texas that have banned them. So I'm not saying it's going one way or the other. It's sort of the typical American paradox. I would also note that, again, I just wanted to reemphasize the point. I started my comments by noting how immigration and race are intertwined. And my concern would be that we could well be doing better on the immigration policy front and still be doing substantially worse on the quote-unquote race front writ large. And just to give you a couple of examples, almost the entire civil rights enforcement infrastructure, short of the most basic civil rights enforcement laws, so civil rights laws were adopted in the 64, 65, and 68. Then there was a period from 68 till about 1980 where there was this entire other infrastructure around affirmative action and testing and a whole bunch of stuff, and that's basically gone. And probably the last remnant of affirmative action in college admissions is probably also going to be gone sooner rather than later. The state voter ID laws and other measures are effectively going to be undermining what's left of value in terms of the Voting Rights Act in a lot of places. So all I'm saying is I don't deny the sort of broad arc of history in the next half century or something like that. We're going to be doing a lot better, probably on the pure immigration policy front. I continue to have deep worries about how successful our sort of multicultural experiment and whether that the pace of change will be as rapid as I would hope it would.
Thank you, Charlie. I wanted to ask a question of someone from the audience. We have with us Brian Grant, who is with the Migration Policy Institute now, and his last two jobs, he was Director General of different components of this issue in the Canadian government. And in all of our conversations, in the United States, it's easy to forget Canada. Suppose I didn't say that. Okay, but I'm afraid that I did. But in all conversations about immigration and, all of these populism, anti-immigration movements, et cetera, the outlier is Canada. We know that there's ferment, below the data and the surveys and all that, but it's not ferment that in any way, reaches, anything significant. And if you can take 2 minutes and say a few things to us about what is it about, not the magic of Canada, because there's no magic in this business, but what is it that Canada seems to be working hard at that brings about somewhat different results, or it seems to sort of not have these extreme peaks and valleys that the issue has in some of the other countries that we've been discussing here. Just 2 minutes, if you don't mind.
This is like the party. This happens, seems to happen all the time. At some point in the party, everyone's had a lot to drink and laughed loudly, and then they asked for the 5-year-old kid with the bow tie to come out and play the piano. So the official story of Canada, I think Canada does this well, but the official story tells too good a story. But I don't think it tells a false story. That what we've heard today But Canada is seen as an outlier, but there's nothing inherently different about Canada. And Canada could well have gone down the same road that both the United States and Europe have. But it was perhaps in a fortunate position at one point, and it took a turn at that point, and it was able to take that turn at that point, and it changed the course. And it's important that we don't always dismiss Canada as an outlier, but look at what it did and see what, you know, one could possibly learn from that. Canada coming out of the Second World War is a very young country. I was in the first wave of people in Canada who was born as a Canadian citizen. If I'd been born 3 years earlier, I would have been a British subject. So it was a very young country, and it wanted to assert itself and to separate itself from its colonial past. And it started a series of changes, mostly social policy changes, that stretched, well, from citizenship in 47, but really stretched from the early 1960s to the early 1980s, a 20-year period during which dramatic changes to the structure of Canadian society were made. And these were things like the Official Languages Act, a new flag that didn't have the Union Jack, the Multiculturalism Act, culminated in the patriation of the Canadian Constitution from the Parliament in Westminster, and the adoption of a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which created individual rights for all Canadians. And what's significant about all of this package of social policy changes is it happened at the same time that I thought that immigration changed, and immigration changed because of a decision in 67 enacted in the mid-70s that said that Canada could no longer discriminate and only take immigrants from Europe. And so against this backdrop of social change, slowly Canada started to fill up with immigrants who looked differently. But by that time, as they started to move in, the nature of Canada had essentially been changed. The Canadians redefined who they were. And most of these policies that created whatever tolerance exists in Canada for immigrants had absolutely nothing to do with immigrants, but were directed at native-born Canadians and how they thought about themselves. And that had a powerful effect. Now, the second thing that happened, of course, is that the immigrants started to flood into, I mean, we think of it as a large landmass. Actually, it's a very small country. They went into very few cities. And somewhere in the... I should just say that all of these social policy changes were met with very divisive debate. People were very angry at all of these things, the flag, the language, the whole thing. And some of them went to the Supreme Court. But at some point towards the latter 1980s, the divisiveness stopped. And the opinion leaders everyone started to speak positively about immigration. And the political reality, of course, was that the immigrants were filling up the constituencies in the cities and in the peripheries of the cities. And they were it became an incredibly powerful voice. So much so that the Conservative Party that's now in power realized about 10 years ago that the only way it had the rural vote, the only way it could form the government was to make its way into the cities and started to court the ethnic vote. And we're highly successful on that. And now no politician would say the things that are said in Europe or in the United States because we sue so. Final point, very quick point. Jason Kennedy, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration in Canada, was in town a few weeks ago, and I went over and had a chat with him with some other people. And he was talking about changes he's made, and he's made some very tough changes in terms of addressing abuse of the immigration system and stripping Canadian citizens of their citizenship for obtaining it fraudulently. And he maintains that his strongest support comes from the ethnic communities, who felt that they played fairly and they do not want other people. So they even have the strength of the enforcement now starting to come from the ethnic communities.
Thank you very much, Brian. I knew you were going to reinforce the mind and the store, you know, point of Frank, that, you know, the fact that we're losing our audience. So
we're just going to keep talking.
What I think that we need to do now, very regrettably from my end, because I wanted to say a few things myself, and it's bad time management on my part, I suspect, I'd like to thank our speakers for terrific insights and presentations, all of you. I want to thank you, our friends and colleagues who come to our events. It's, you know, we're part of a single community that cares about these issues regardless of how we may feel politically or perhaps ideologically about this. I invite you to stick around, continue your conversations among yourselves or with some of our panel, and hope to see you at our next event. And remember, on your chair, you have the council statement, you know, after every meeting of the Transatlantic Council, we publish a council statement that tries to sort of put together all of the, you know, sort of a narrative of not what happened. This is not about what happened. This is about how to think about the issue that we discussed in the meeting, the latest meeting of the Transatlantic Council. And outside, you have not only Tata's and Patrick's paper, but a number of other papers and some of the books that have been produced by the Council. Thank you very much. Have a great evening.
For more information on MPI's Transatlantic Council on Migration, please visit migrationpolicy.org/transatlantic.